it for this. I'm excited to talk to you.
Well, that's good. So, and see, we might convert you to become a fundraiser. You never know.
Well, I would like that, actually.
All right. So, here's a quick little question and tip for you.
Okay.
So, oh, I even see you. Hi. Oh, the Greg guy, he's making all this work. I just love it. So, do you know who Tom Ahern is? Ahern.
I know the name.
Okay. So he's the Tom who lives with me. And he is, see, you would be a natural potentially to take what you know already about communications and then to become an expert in donor communications. See, you're the kind of partner we want, Tom, with our fundraisers if you buy into what donor-centered communications is. So you could subscribe to his semi-monthly newsletter. And he has a wonderful book that talks about making money with donor newsletters, which is quite amazing. And he has a new book that just came out, I don't know, a couple weeks ago, I think, called What Donors Want and Why. And it has a little puppy face on the front. And so think about that. Okay, think about that, both of you, Greg and Tom. When you see a little puppy face or a kitty face, what do you do? Aw, exactly. And actually, there's something in biology called the cuteness factor. So we are biologically designed to have the young who are cute so that the adults don't kill and eat them. So that was a biological evolution thing. So you could be a real natural, Tom, if you start looking at some of these things around donor-centered communications, because you can add that to your own communications knowledge, and then you'll be a really important fundraising partner.
All right. Well, that's what I'm hoping to do.
Good, good.
Because as you know, this is where the money is.
Oh, in the philanthropic sector, it's where the money is. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Boy, the salaries you could earn and like the bonuses. Yeah. It's called love. It's not called, whatever. So, do we have anybody else with us, Greg?
Yeah, they graduate students obviously are not known for their timeliness, so maybe just a couple minutes they'll
Okay.
bring
I'm not
in.
worried. Yeah. So, can you see, Tom, the screen?
Yes, I can.
Okay, so those are the things we're going to talk about.
So now the now,
Yeah, right.
credentialing,
Right.
bother.
And then another then. You can see I'm quite eloquent. And in actuality, I saw that when Greg sent out the announcement for the link for the program, he did send out also the little handout of references, resources that I suggested.
Yes, I saw that.
Yeah, and that's just the tip of the iceberg. It was just what I was, thinking about last night. The actual PowerPoint, there's actually no text in the PowerPoint. It's just me amusing myself with each one of these titles and a funny little picture. So it's all going to be talking. So I'm counting on you. I might even just yell out, could the Tom guy or anybody else named Tom please say something? Because I like the interaction part.
All right.
So I actually teach at St. Mary's University in Minnesota in their master's program in philanthropy and development.
Oh, all right.
Yeah, and I teach live there for I teach governance and then a sort of an introductory course about life and stuff. And it's live, and we're in the classroom Monday through Saturday from 8 a.m. to 5 p.m. and half a day on Sunday.
Whoa.
Right. So part of the program is online, and then there's 2 weeks every for 3 summers live. Live in
Wow.
dorms. Yeah.
That's intense.
Yeah, and actually, it's one of the things I like about it because something can come up, right? And then we can talk about it the next day. It's not next week or next month.
Mm-hmm.
And I really like the live stuff, and I, you know, make people, you know, I make people do small group work and everything. It's really cool.
Excuse me for a second. I'm going to close my door because they're planning the annual auction next door, and they're making quite a bit.
I can only imagine how potentially loud that is.
I actually had a quick question. The certification that you have with your name as the ADVDIP, so, how would you pronounce that?
Oh, I don't. It actually means advanced diploma.
Oh.
So okay. What I do is I just say ACFRE and an ADVDIP, and what the hell are either one of those?
Okay. I know the ACFRE.
No, I know. Right.
Advanced diploma, is that a French one or?
No, it's it's the International Advanced Diploma in Fundraising. That's what it's.
Oh, okay.
Which has been offered like 3 times and may not be offered again in the United States.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, which would be unfortunate, but anyway. So
that was the ACRFE, like the CRFE where it's recognized worldwide.
The CFRE is recognized worldwide. The ACFRE is an advanced credential, and advanced credentials typically come out of a professional association, whereas the CFRE does not come out of a professional association. It's an independent credential. And so the ACFRE comes out of AFP. There's also another advanced credential that comes out of Healthcare Association, the Association for Healthcare Philanthropy, which is called the FAHP, which is a fellow of AHP. Yeah. So, yeah, little acronyms.
So this is where I heard his name before.
Yes. Yes, that book. Indeed. Yeah. That's the case statement book.
Right.
Yep. Indeed, indeed. So someone in your office has it.
I actually bought this after I took our fundraising class at mm-hmm. USF.
Good. Yeah. Yep. Yeah. Well, and he's because he's a professional writer, they're really quick reads.
Mm-hmm.
So he writes really well, and they're small, as you noticed.
Which is good because I'm not very good at reading.
Ah. Yes, yeah, they're good. The publisher that published that is a publisher called Emerson and Church, and his model for his books are all very short books like that. There's a whole series, tons of them.
Great.
Yeah, about boards, fundraising, all kinds of things. Yeah. Well, my clock says it's like 7:10 or something.
Yeah, let's go ahead. We'll probably have more students join us on the way in transit. So let me go ahead and introduce you. So the first name, Simone, how do I say your last name?
Just say Joyeux.
Joyeux, okay.
That's fine.
Yeah. All right, yeah, welcome everyone to the webinar. We're incredibly appreciative for today's speaker. Simone P. Joyeux, ACFRE, and Advanced Diploma is described as, quote, one of the most thoughtful, inspirational, and provocative leaders in the philanthropic sector worldwide. In 2017, Simone began her 30th year as a full-time consultant. She specializes in fund development, strategic planning, and board development and governance. Since her early days in the sector, Simone has served on many boards. She's a former chair of CFRE International and the immediate past chair of Planned Parenthood of Southern New England. Currently, she chairs the advisory board for the Hartsook Center for Sustainable Philanthropy in the United Kingdom. Simone speaks worldwide, enjoying the opportunity to work with colleagues in places like Mexico City, London, Paris, Italy, Belgium, Australia, New Zealand, the Netherlands, and Slovakia. She also teaches in the philanthropy graduate program at St. Mary's University of Minnesota. And as well, she's written 3 books, Keep Your Donors, co-authored with Tom Ahern, strategic fund development, which we use as our fundraising textbook, and it's now in its third edition. And my favorite, firing lousy board members.
Yes.
Which every executive director should have a copy by their desk.
Indeed.
Yeah, she's contributed to several other books, writes for the Nonprofit Quarterly, and blogs weekly as Simone Uncensored. Without further ado, thank you so much, and the floor is yours, Ms. Joyle. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Greg. So, hello, everyone. Just some general guidelines for this session. Please feel free to ask questions at any time. Just yell them out to Greg. Let's try to engage a little bit back and forth. So the first thing I sort of want to know is, how many of you already work in a nonprofit? And I know Tom Casey and I were just speaking, and I know he works in a nonprofit. How many of the rest of you work in nonprofits right now?
So I do, and I know for our full-time cohort, about half, about eight okay. people work in it.
All right. How many of you aspire to be a fundraiser? Oh, okay. Tom, I can see Tom. He's raising his hand. Greg has already told me he's completely and totally disinterested. So.
Well, I'm at ED, so obviously it's going to have to.
Yeah. You're at ED, so you do have to know this stuff, yeah. Some of it, yeah. So think about it in terms of, if you plan to become or already are an executive director, a program staff person in a nonprofit, you still have to know some minimal things about fundraising. Because we have to create within our organizations a culture of philanthropy. So think a little bit about organizational culture as we're talking today, and the degree to which you read a lot about it. As I recall, don't you have organizational culture sort of in your curriculum, Greg? Okay, I've lost you.
I had it on mute. Okay. Yes, in our board governance course.
Good. So organizational culture, the personality of an organization. When you work in the philanthropic sector, in the nonprofit sector, everybody has to understand fundraising to some degree because it's a major financial stream. It's a revenue stream to survive. So anyway, we're going to talk a little bit about fundraising, the ACFRE, the sort of credentialing process. What you see, as I say, on the screen right now are the topics that we're going to be talking about. And so I want to start out with introducing myself. I made my career goal decision when I was 9 years old. I was going to be a French and English teacher, like in middle school or high school. That's all I ever wanted to be. I designed my entire life that way. I went to school for that, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And I never found a teaching job. Needless to say, I was really bummed out. So then I fell into nonprofits, you know, totally by mistake. I always like to say they were dumb enough and smart enough to hire me, this organization. I was dumb enough and smart enough to have applied. And it turned out that I fell in love with the nonprofit sector. So I was an executive director for a while. I was a chief development officer. Then someone suggested maybe I should try consulting, which I was really sure I was not going to like because I wouldn't be committed to one mission. Well, it turns out that what I became committed to as a consultant was change. I see myself as a change agent. I challenge people. I ask cage-rattling questions. I'm a justice person, all that sort of thing. So that's who I am. I am ending my 30th year as a full-time consultant right now, which just seems unbearably weird. But anyway, so now, the now of me, I started realizing that just learning through my professional association, so think about it a moment, whatever profession you ultimately choose, let's say you decide you're going to become an architect, there's an architects association. And I believe that if we're going to be professionals, we join a professional association. So I joined something called NSFRE back in 1984, the National Society of Fundraising Executives, which then morphed into the Association of Fundraising Professionals. And it's interesting because one of the things I really bought into as I started in the nonprofit field, and then as I really morphed into I'm going to be a fundraiser, was I started reading about what it means to be a professional, and I started listening to what my professional association, NSFRE, then AFP, began talking about. And I learned several really important things, okay? I learned that we define a profession by a body of knowledge, research to keep learning and to change and update the body of knowledge, a code of ethics, continuing education. And then the last one was certification. So I said to myself, if I'm going to be a fundraiser, then I'm going to buy into all of those things. Naturally, I was going to conferences. Back in 1984, when I got into the field, there were no graduate programs in fundraising and philanthropy. There were probably not very many nonprofit administration programs. So you're lucky that there are so many choices now. So I felt like, well, then I've got to get a credential. And the credential that existed and still exists is the CFRE, Certified Fundraising Executive. So I decided I should get a credential. I was going to do tons of continuing education, right? I was going to learn and learn and learn. And that's what I did. Now, I will tell you that the downside, okay, of being a professional and credentialing is there's like a test, right? So the really cool thing that really resonated with me about getting my CFRE and then my ACFRE, so Certified Fundraising Executive, then Advanced Certified Fundraising Executive. You can't get the ACFRE without having the CFRE. What I really appreciated and what really resonated with me, as I said, was one, that to be credentialed, you had to volunteer in the sector. You had to actually be a philanthropist. The definition of philanthropy is voluntary action for the common good. So if any of you online in the room, if any of you volunteer anywhere, whether it's serving meals at the soup kitchen, whether it's serving on a board, which as an aside, you want to work in the nonprofit sector, you must serve on a board. There's nothing quite like being a board member to understand what being a board member means when you start working with the board members that you have to work with if you're working in a nonprofit organization. So, both the CFRE and the ACFRE, you have to qualify to even be able to apply. And it includes, as I say, volunteering. It includes, of course, continuing education. It includes actual practice. Like, you can't apply for the CFRE until you've actually been working in the field for a number of years. And I know Dr. Alexander is going to be talking with you about the CFRE. Then the same thing happens with the ACFRE. After you have the CFRE, if you want to get the advanced certification, you have to qualify, as in you volunteer. You work in the field, you are a practitioner, you are a fundraiser. And in both cases, then you have to take a test. Now, I don't know when the last time was you guys took a test, because maybe in your master's program, you don't actually take tests, you just write papers. I've never been good at multiple choice tests. I'm much more of an essayist, because see, when I'm looking at the multiple choice questions and the answers, I'm thinking, well, it could be A, except on Tuesdays. If it rains, it couldn't be A. It could be B, but You know, only if you're short. Because tall people, it couldn't be. I mean, I've got reasons why. So anyway, multiple choice tests. So I had to take a multiple choice test for CFRE as well as ACFRE. Now, ACFRE, the advanced certification, is not only the multiple choice test, which, by the way, you do have to pass in order to move to the next step. The coolest part, though, of the ACFRE was the portfolio preparation. They give you very specific guidelines about what kinds of work you have to have done, and you have to submit examples. I had a ball looking through my, let's see, I did the ACFRE in 1994, the second class of ACFRE applicants. So I'd been working in the field since 1980, so 14 years. I was looking back at all my stuff, and I was looking at the good stuff and the stuff that wasn't so good. And I was looking at things and thinking, wow, I would do that differently now. I don't think I'll put that in the portfolio. So you had to prepare this portfolio. As I recall, my portfolio was 2 3-ring, 3-inch binders. It's my understanding that after I submitted mine, they made a rule about how much you could or couldn't submit. Just saying. Then the other thing that's interesting is you have to do a personal interview. And it's like a PhD where, you know, you have an interview or oral exams with your committee for a doctorate. This, you had to go to Washington, D.C., because that's where the office of AFP is, and you had to sit with the board, and they asked you questions about life, fundraising, your portfolio. So we had to talk, and while it was certainly vaguely informal, it is nonetheless a test, so to speak. So anyway, I did that. Credentialing, why bother? Because I figure if you're going to be a professional, you have to buy into the things that the profession is talking about. And I think what's very interesting is when you think about fundraising in particular, nonprofits in general, some of the things are different than they are in a traditional for-profit business. Some of them are very much the same. Some of them come with the experience of being a non-governmental organization. Because if you think about the world, okay, we have three sectors. We have the nonprofit sector, we have the government sector, and we have the for-profit sector. And those three sectors make a civil society. They have some of the same rules, but some of the rules are different. The nonprofit sector and its financial model is vastly different than the for-profit sector. And this is something as you think about your next steps in your career, is this really the place you want to be? And if it is, are you willing to learn the stuff that needs to be learned? Are you willing to challenge the assumptions of a society? So one of the things that is of great concern to me, of great, great concern, is that we hear a lot now about, we hear a lot about how businesses, or nonprofits rather, excuse me, nonprofits need to operate more like businesses. This is something that I would urge you to talk about if you haven't already in your program. What does it mean to operate more like a business? There's a man called Michael Edwards, okay, who is we used to work with the Ford Foundation, used to work for the World Bank. Now, Mike has a wonderful little book, which I didn't happen to put in my list, but I'm going to share it with you now. It's called Small Change, Why Business Won't Save the World. And it is a book that talks about the essence of being nonprofits. It talks about justice. It talks about making changes that the government can't or won't address anymore, that for-profits won't venture into. That's the value, the beauty, the specialness of the nonprofit sector. So as we think about being a professional in the sector, yes, credentialing is a part of it. But there's more than credentialing. There's the kind of continual studying we have to do. You see here, I just had fun with PowerPoint. I just decided that I wasn't going to actually put substantive content into the PowerPoint, but I was rather going to make cute little pictures, see all the files. So as we think about, okay, studying, whether it's for a credential or not, let me ask you a question. When you leave this program and you go into the world or you return to your current job, what will you do to keep yourself fresh, informed? Let's just use technology, for example. Do any of you remember the olden days before the internet? Or before Facebook? Or before Apple iPads? Do you remember iPods before there were iPhones? How is it that we continue learning? Do you believe, as I do, that life is continual learning? That we have to stay current in any profession that we pick? That we have to even venture beyond the specific profession and expand our thinking? So how do we do that? I was teaching one of my courses at St. Mary's more recently, and one of the questions that I posed to the students, and this was online, was, what are the 5, 6, 10, 3, whatever they are, regular online print, whatever, publications you read, blogs, authors you follow, to keep current, to inspire you? Now, I put a bunch from a fundraising perspective and just a nonprofit perspective on the resource list that Greg passed out, distributed via email. So for example, how many of you read Seth Godin? How many of you know who he is? Seth Godin is a serial entrepreneur. He has started bunches of businesses that are all successful, by the way. He writes bunches of books. He has a daily free blog. You subscribe, it comes each day. He talks about marketing. He talks about life. He talks about challenges. He talks about business management. He talks about things that every single one of us in this room, so to speak, today could benefit by reading. I read him and I think, wow, that has direct impact on the strategic planning I have to do with a client tomorrow. Wow, that's something I need to think about the next time I write a donor communications piece. So Seth Godin is an example. So I'm really curious, and I suggest that you all, if you haven't already, shared in one of your classes, who are we reading? Who do we follow? Because things change. Not only, though, do they change, but reading a thought from someone else can give us an insight. That moment when Greg, as an executive director, needs one slightly new angle so that he can talk with board members about fundraising. And just as an aside, Greg, there is the most beautiful blog by Seth Godin. So you can find it. You search it with the following words, everyone. Narcissism, perfume, brand. Okay? You search that, and you will read from Seth a description of the concept of brand and marketing, and whether it's things we buy or whether it's places we give money to or volunteer our time to. It's about how we represent ourselves. Now, Greg, if by any chance you have found it, did you find it by chance?
I'm researching that right now.
Okay, because if it pops up, or when it pops up, brand narcissism, Seth Godin's blog, perfume, I would love it if you would read it to everybody. So just yell out when you find it. It's brief. So I want you to think about whether you're going after a credential like CFRE or eventually ACFRE, they keep wanting to know, are we continuing our professional development? What are we reading? What are we doing? What are we learning? Because with the advent of social media, it's not the answer to everything. I'm sure you've figured that one out. It's not the only way to raise money. In fact, it's not a great way to raise money, and we don't think it will be until something like 2025. But anyway, it has a role in relationship building. So things continue to evolve, change, mature, etc. And it's up to us as leaders in whatever our chosen field is to engage people in conversations about these things.
So I was able to pull it up.
Okay, please read it. And I want everybody to, like, I don't know, close your eyes and really listen to this. It is beautiful and it is fundamental to any business, for profit or nonprofit, and it is critical for fundraising. Go.
So it looks like it's a little piece and it's titled "The Brand is a Story, but it's a story about you, not about the brand." It's just a couple paragraphs. Why prefer Coke over Pepsi or GE over Samsung or Ford over Chevy? In markets that aren't natural monopolies or where they are clear, agreed upon metrics, how do we decide? Yes, every brand has a story. That's how it goes from being a logo and a name to a brand. The story includes expectations and history and promises and social cues and emotions. The story makes us say we quote-unquote love Google or quote-unquote love Harley, but what do we really love? We love ourselves. We love the memory we have of that brand made us feel once. We love that it reminds us of our mom or growing up or our first kiss. We support a charity or a soccer team or a perfume because it gives us a chance to love something about ourselves. We can't easily explain this even to ourselves. We can't easily acknowledge the narcissism and the nostalgia that drives so many of the apparently rational decisions we make every day. But that doesn't mean they're not at work. More than ever, we express ourselves with that, with what we buy and how we use what we buy. Extensions of our personality, totems of ourself, reminders of who we are or would like to be. Great marketers don't buy stuff, they make meaning.
So really think about that. Whether you're Apple, and boy, talk about a company that understands that, Apple. But right now we're talking about nonprofits and your positioning in this field and your commitment to this sector. And one of the most important things to understand about the nonprofit sector and your own personal professional development is that it is about fulfilling the aspirations of others. One of the most important things we say in fundraising is people give, and when I say give, I mean give their time, their volunteer time, or give a financial contribution people give through an organization to fulfill their own aspirations. They don't give to your nonprofit to help you have more money to do stuff. They've identified themselves with your organization. So I look at something like Planned Parenthood, where Greg mentioned in my bio that I've been the chair of Planned Parenthood of Southern New England. I believe that women's rights are basic human rights. I believe that reproductive justice is a fundamental human right. And I identify with all of that. It's part of my overall belief in justice and the fact that we do not have social justice. And so as I look into the world, I say, where can I give through to fulfill my own aspirations? What organizations are doing what I identify with and need to be done? So think of that as a frame, if you will, for working in this sector, as a frame for deciding you're going to be a professional, which you all have done because you're getting a master's degree. And think of it as whether you get a credential, which you might choose to do, you might not. Just remember that a master's degree does not substitute for a credential, and a credential doesn't substitute for a master's degree. So, one of the other interesting things about credentialing is that something like the CFRE, you have to renew. You have to renew it every 3 years because a credential is called a practice credential, and it means you've got to renew it. The ACFRE, on the other hand, you don't have to renew, which, in my opinion, my professional opinion, weakens it. It becomes more of a honorific in many ways. I mean, you had to have qualified, you have to have succeeded and done all sorts of things, but it is a terminal credential, and typically credentials aren't terminal. Anyway, so that's a little bit around CFRE and ACFRE. One of the things that I did notice, though, as I was going through my early years in fundraising and pursuing credentialing and going to conferences and reading fundraising books, I realized along the way that just fundraising wasn't going to cut it. Just knowing about fundraising and having a fundraising credential wasn't going to cut it. What I realized was that there was so much else to learn. Now remember, I wanted to be an English and French teacher, so that's the stuff I was learning, right? I wasn't learning business theory. I wasn't learning systems thinking and learning organization business theories. If you haven't read systems thinking and learning organization business theories in your program, you want to definitely read them on your own. Peter Senge, I believe I wrote him on my little favorite resources list. The concept of conversation as a core business practice. All of these sorts of things. So what I started doing was saying, Simon, you cannot just read about fundraising and you can't just read about nonprofits, which of course, again, is part of your curriculum. You're not just reading about nonprofits. So I don't know, some 30 years ago, I subscribed to the Harvard Business Review. You really ought to read the Harvard Business Review. They're reporting on research. They have marvelous articles about leadership and conversation and systems thinking and personnel and everything. So I started reading all kinds of business books. Two of the most powerful books that I have read in the last decade almost are on the list. One is called The Hidden Brain by Shankar Vedantam, who's the New York Times science editor. And since he's in the New York Times, he writes well, so it's easy to read, loosely speaking. And the other was Alone Together by Sherry Turkle. I believe every executive director, every professional in any field, mostly every single human being of a, you know, adultish age should read The Hidden Brain and Alone Together. Alone Together is about technology. Turkle does not say, oh, well, we're too addicted to technology, we should stop it. She doesn't say that because you can't stop it. But she does say technology is not the answer to everything. And she gives particular stories and research that are disappointing and scary for the future of humankind, if you will. Shankar Vedantam in The Hidden Brain. The Hidden Brain is the little piece back here called the amygdala. It's called the lizard brain. It's the place that says, oh my God, saber-toothed tiger coming, run, run for your lives. And that unconscious mind of ours, despite the fact that we don't want to be racist or sexist or homophobic, the unconscious mind takes us there. We have to be sufficiently aware of the unconscious mind to fight that unconscious and to stand up for what we believe in. Fascinating, fascinating research on transgender, on the position of women, race, etc. And I don't know how we can be, I don't know, thoughtful, good human beings in any business, in any life, if we don't pay attention to some of that stuff. So that was what happened to me along the way, was I started reading about all these things. And what I've put on this little PowerPoint is photographs of things in my office. You know, favorite little buttons, little comments about feminism, changing the face of power. And let me tell you, you work in the nonprofit sector or the for-profit sector. And issues about power, race, gender, generation are flourishing, in case you haven't noticed, recently in our own media in this country. Again, those are all things to look at if we're going to be good managers, if we're going to be good leaders, the whole concept of leadership and how we develop leaders. So, I once wrote, I have a very, very active website. I have a free download library that has dozens of handouts, materials about nonprofits, tools that I've developed, surveys that I've developed, job descriptions for positions, for boards, et cetera, et cetera. All of those are there for free. And organizations all around the world take them, edit them a little bit, stick them on their own letterhead, and use them. And that's the whole point. Now, if you're going to like include them in a book you're writing, you do have to give, you know, credit to me. But otherwise, go there. Look at those things. Use them in your own work. So one of the things that's in my free download library is something called opinion versus expertise. And you'll kind of see that in the little guys, you know, standing on the building on this slide. Don't worry, gravity is just a theory. The bliss of anti-science. There are facts. There's a body of knowledge in fundraising and in governance. Two of my favorite topics. What's absolutely amazing is that you will learn these things, and then I'm just warning you, you're going to go back to your office if you currently work in the sector. You're going to go to like your executive director, and you will have written. So this is a call out to Tom Casey. You're going to learn how to write like direct mail really well. You're going to go and you're going to show it to your boss and say, here's our next direct mail letter, please sign. And he or she is going to say, no, I'm sorry, Tom, but that's just not my voice. I don't talk like that. Oh, and by the way, I'm the founder of the local chapter of the Grammar Police, and you've made some grammatical errors. Now, the facts say that you can make grammatical errors. You can actually have a sentence in a direct mail letter that doesn't have a verb. It's okay. You can even have a one-word paragraph, which my typing teacher and my English teacher told me was a sin of tantamount proportions. So, you got to get really good at this stuff, people, because you've got to be able to go in and say, I'm sorry, but see, actually, there's research on this, and there are facts, and the facts say, blah, 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 blah. I once had a very interesting experience. I was working with a board that was just a one-off, not a long-term client. And I was explaining, talking about some of the facts in fundraising in order for them to raise more money. And virtually everything I said, someone on the board or a staff person was kind of saying, well, we don't agree with that or we don't believe that. So at some point, I made some statement and a gentleman reached over and this was many years ago, and he patted me on the arm and he said, well, Missy, I've served on more boards than you are old. And the reason I say it was a long time ago was because maybe he had. And I looked at him and I said, but I'm right and you're wrong. And here's the IRS handout. And after the session, the CEO, executive director, and board chair said to me, we'll never ask you to come again because you can't talk to people that way. Now, I got to tell you, if I were like writing this in Twitter, I would go WTF, right? You asked me here because I'm an expert, but you believe your opinion is better than or more important than expertise. So that's just a little warning, because in fact, the nonprofit sector is not understood well enough. Fundraising is not yet sufficiently documented through academic research, and you're going to run into people where the power dynamics will be immense. Your board members, so just ask any executive director you know, ask any of your classmates who are executive directors, do they have problems sometimes at a board meeting when one of your board members, who's also that really powerful person in town, remember, you know, the woman who like owns the biggest company in town, whatever. And she says, yeah, but you know, I don't agree with that. And you're in a position of having to say, yeah, but see, the research says blah, 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 and you're wrong. This is something that happens, and it happens more, I think, in the nonprofit sector than in the for-profit sector. Because somehow, the nonprofit sector is just not quite actually, you know, real or something like that. So do we have any questions thus far, Greg?
There's none that appear on the chat, but actually I just had a comment, which I'm hoping is kind of with that. So our board has actually kind of made a implied policy. We don't do the board members have to donate type thing.
Mm-hmm.
And in particular, there was a national nonprofit that actually was inquiring with me about serving as a board member. And I was very excited. I love this organization and so forth. And then they said, the expected contribution is $25,000.
I'm sorry.
Yeah. So I just realized, well, I love you, but not that much.
Yeah.
So our board has just done that because we actually believe it's kind of might translate to a pay-to-play type thing.
Mm-hmm.
And we'd rather have the expertise of the board members than rather their pocketbook. So I'm just curious, have you seen that dichotomy?
Yeah.
Okay.
It happens all the time. But here's the way I approach it, okay? So the people closest to the organization, to the nonprofit, are the executive director and the board and its members, right? You're the ones that are closest to the organization. You cannot ask others to give a gift if you do not give a financial contribution yourselves. So what I always say is, and you will see this actually in my free download library, so it's performance expectations of board members. Number one, regularly attend board meetings, because governance is a group process. So you could be our best friend and the biggest donor we have or whatever, but if you don't go to board meetings, you're not a good board member. It's not negotiable. So regularly attend board meetings. Number two, come prepared to board meetings. Read the stuff in advance. Don't, oh, I see your face, Greg, and you've had this experience. Somebody comes to
having it right now.
Okay. So, you know, you say you got to bring your materials. You have to have read them. This is a business meeting. You have legal and moral liabilities here as a board member. Then I say, give a personal financial contribution every year to the best of your personal ability. Because we can't ask anybody else to give money if we don't give money ourselves. And I will tell you that foundation after foundation now is getting madder and madder that we don't have 100% giving by the board members. And I know foundations who will not accept a proposal if you don't have 100% giving. Now, at the same time, and I'm very clear about this, and this is clear in all my materials in my library, there are people, it can't be pay to play. That's awful. That violates the concept of justice. And furthermore, some of the best potential board members may only be able to give $25, but we want them on our board. So I always use the example of the single father with six children who works in the San Francisco public school system's kitchen. But he would be great on our board. He would attend board meetings. He has very interesting insights about some of the services we do. He will make donor thank you calls, blah, 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 blah. And when I'm interviewing him to serve on the board, I go over all these things. And we ask each board member to give a gift. And I know that you know that Mary Jones is on our board. And of course, she's the CEO of the largest company in the city. So, you know, we ask people to give to the best of their personal ability. So would you consider, for example, a gift of $25, sir? And that's what he would be asked for. But to not be expected to give a financial contribution, you go ask somebody else for a gift, and I'm looking at you going, so your board members don't give, neither does your executive director, but you want me to? Screw you.
Good point.
Now, yes, there are all kinds of boards where they say you have to give or get $1,000 or something. Well, I don't think it's give or get. I think it's give and help nurture relationships. But I do not believe in establishing a figure. I believe it's personalized to the individual, and that individual board member deserves a personal request for that gift. Does that make sense?
Yes, perfectly.
Yeah, so it's, you know, all of this sort of stuff is, it's, we have to have these conversations and then we have to set these guidelines, rules, policies in our organizations. Okay, so along the way, I was starting to read all kinds of other things and thinking about power and justice and everything. And then I was invited to teach at St. Mary's University. That's their logo, but you will notice the picture. Yes, that is me with pom-poms. I don't exactly remember what the pom-poms had to do with anything, but some of the students came in and they had pom-poms, apparently, and then they challenged me to jumping with pom-poms. But you will see all of the flip charts and all of the conversations we had about everything and anything from power and justice to gender and generation, to major donors and I hate the term major donors, and I refuse to use it. Because if you use the term major donors, does that imply that there are like minor donors? If there are major donors and major gifts, then there are minor donors and minor gifts. And I don't know about the rest of you, but I'm really not pleased to be called minor. one of the things that many of us say in fundraising is the donor decides what a major gift is. Because honestly, what's a major gift to me is a little different than a major gift to Bill and Melinda. So I began thinking more and more about academic education as I was teaching at St. Mary's. And one of the things that happened, see the big fireworks, hugely important, all over the world. And then the little thingy there, microscope is for research. If you do not know who Adrian Sargent is, S-A-R-G-E-A-N-T, you should expect to be introduced to him in your fundraising curricula. Adrian is from the UK. He's the world's foremost academic researcher in fundraising. So let me parse that sentence if I could. We have some wonderful centers for philanthropy in the United States. In fact, the first center for philanthropy was started at Indiana University, Purdue University in Indianapolis. It is now the Lilly Family School of Philanthropy. It was the first center for philanthropy, and it is now the first school for philanthropy in the world. They study philanthropy and people giving and all that sort of stuff. It's a marvelous place. It does wonderful research. I'm hoping you're all checking them out for their research. There's a difference between philanthropy and fundraising. Philanthropy, again, is voluntary action for the common good. I choose to give my time, my money. Fundraising is, as Hank Rosso, a big name, once said, fundraising is the servant of philanthropy. Because you know why the biggest reason is anybody gives? Somebody suggested, Greg, Alyssa, someone, what's the biggest reason anybody ever gives?
Well, I would say to validate themselves, but that's probably wrong.
No, that's actually not bad. That's a kind of a nice thing, and it does link to a few comments in a minute. Yeah, you're breaking up.
I have a feeling Alyssa is going to say because they're asked.
Yes! Yes! The biggest reason anybody gives anything is because they're asked. I mean, just think about it a minute, okay?
Oh, is it? I think affinity.
Yeah, breaking up, can't hear. The biggest reason anybody ever gives is because they're asked. So imagine that you're sitting at home. Actually, you're in your kitchen and you're baking. And you need sugar because you forgot to buy sugar. What do we usually do? We go next door, right? And ask if we can borrow some sugar. Because what, do we actually think that our next door neighbor is going to run up and down the street saying, hi, does anybody need any sugar? We do things because we're asked. And there's nothing wrong with that. So, philanthropy is voluntarily giving. Fundraising is the process of asking. And indeed, Greg, a whole lot of it is about self-validation. So here's another name for you to write down after Adrian Sargent. And Adrian's last name is S-A-R-G-E-A-N-T. So Adrian's business associate colleague and wife is a woman named Jen Shang, S-H-A-N-G. Jen is the world's first and still only philanthropic psychologist. So when she looks at giving, philanthropy, and fundraising, the asking, she's looking at it in terms of what's it doing to you or me as a person? How does it validate who we are? How does it fulfill our need as a human being? So the then another then that I experienced was Adrian Sargent and Jen Chang's work and the work of academic researchers in how sociology, psychology, behavioral science, et cetera, is used, can be used in fundraising. And this isn't bad. It's not manipulation. It's understanding enough about social information, for example, to know that people want to be validated, to know what it means to be a human being and what we need as human beings, to be sufficiently knowledgeable about these things that we can use them appropriately to care for people through the fundraising process. So, here's another thing for you to write down. The Hartsook Center for Sustainable Philanthropy, which I believe is on my little list, but maybe it isn't. Hartsook is H-A-R-T-S-O-O-K. It is on it, Greg, on my list. I think it is. And the Hartsook Center is in the UK. And they're doing phenomenal research on relationship building with donors. Phenomenal research. They just published, maybe 6 months ago, a report on creating great fundraising events, which is, it will make it clear to you about certain fundraising events that you've been to that you then say, oh my gosh, no wonder it was such a great event because that's how I felt. And then in other cases, like I love to pick on golf tournaments because really, if you're a rape crisis center, a domestic violence center, if you're a school, whatever, what does golf have to do with your mission? So you just read this creating great fundraising events, and it was the validation for me for why I've always thought they're so dumb. In fact, since you've been using my book, Strategic Fund Development, which makes me very proud and honored, you'll recall that I wrote a lot about systems thinking and learning organization business theories and conversations and all those sorts of things because I had fallen in love with them while reading them myself. So I was just saying, wow, this would be good stuff, I bet, like in nonprofits and stuff, right? Well, in 2013, Sargent and Shang published a report called The Great Fundraising Report. And I'm assuming that may well be something that you're looking at as part of your curriculum, and you certainly should, because they talk about what makes fundraising great. And again, it was based on research, right? So in essence, the research kind of said like systems thinking and team and conversation, all those sorts of things. I was so excited because as far as I was concerned, their academic research, their formal research validated what I wrote in Strategic Fund Development. So I actually wrote them an email. They are professional colleagues and good friends. And I wrote them an email and said, well, you just proved that I was right, that I was just prescient in my book. Okay, so, but that's where it was like, wow, now this stuff is beginning to fit together differently and better and more. And so I was just really excited. Okay. So we're kind of moving along here, right? We're talking about credentialing, why bother, CFRE, ACFRE, learning more than just about fundraising, learning more than just about nonprofits, okay? And so where are we now as a sector? And let me share some of my concerns. So why do you think actually there's the little, you know, gambling wheel there? Because I think we're gambling. I think, oh, Tom, I think we are in the press to raise money. We don't study how best to raise money. In the press to meet that year-end goal, we don't follow best practice. We rush out to do something that was really a gamble. I wonder how many organizations in the nonprofit sector in the US, how many bosses said to their fundraising staff, that ice bucket challenge thing that ALS did, we should invent one. Because if any of you ever heard anybody talking about that, it would be like, oh, please. It just makes no sense. There is a body of knowledge. Learn it. Keep learning it. Confront graciously and professionally your boss, your board, and say, stop it. We're not going down that path. There really is a theory of gravity. We're going to play with facts. Get really good at explaining life to your program staff. Because if you don't, again, here it is, it's just a gamble. We can't play with opinion and not pay attention to expertise. We can't sit on our laurels and not read and learn continuously. We can't allow people who don't know the facts to dominate. Nor can we expect them to learn all the facts. That's not their job. When the finance office tells me that the new FASB regs say ABCD, I don't respond by saying, well, you know, I don't really think we should worry that much about FASB. You know, I mean, what are they? They're just the Financial Accounting Standards Board. It's just a mess. It's just wasted. None of us would say that, for heaven's sake. None of us would say that. It's nuts. But we say it to fundraisers. We say it to fundraisers, and then we're gambling. So, the nonprofit sector, okay, the fundraising sector is not doing well enough in fundraising. Our retention rates are really bad. Anybody ever worked somewhere, you know, like when you were a youth, like in a restaurant or at a bookstore or the grocery store? What happens if customers don't come back? Costs 10 times more money to acquire a new customer or a new donor than it does to keep a current one. We can't keep doing fundraising half-ass. There's too much to risk. All the ultimate beneficiaries, the lives you can save. We just have to be more careful. We've got to get into the right stuff. So, notice the crying person there. It is a crying baby, but the crying person. That to me is an emblem of our, pretend you and I are the crying baby. Insufficient research, insufficient respect for the facts and the body of knowledge that exists. Fundraisers who don't know the names of major players. You know, if you don't, I mean, it's interesting. We can probably all name the most famous movie stars or whatever, but in our own profession, in our own field, if I said to you, okay, so, and I just keep picking on Greg because I actually, you know, have met Greg several times now on the internet here for this, but so if we're looking at the top people in technology, who are they? Who are some of the top names in technology, dead or alive?
Well, we're going to say, you know, Tim Cook.
Right. Right. Steve Jobs.
Larry Ellison.
Right. Do you know who Jaron Lanier is or was? Is?
No.
Okay. Jaron Lanier. Inventor of virtual reality. At the start of the... of all of the technology stuff, the turnarounds, the social media stuff, dreadlocks down to his waist, plays ancient Asian instruments, and several years ago wrote a book called You Are Not a Gadget, withdrew in many ways from the technology sector because he said he felt that we were not being human and humane enough and that we'd made too many bad decisions. Fascinating guy. You can find him on YouTube. But you will not find, like, he does not have a web page or anything. He's in Wikipedia, but he doesn't have any presence on the internet that he puts on the internet. So, unfortunately, we are too easily distracted. We don't have enough academic research in fundraising, but we're getting more. We, you know, there's unclear respect for academic programs. Thank heavens we have universities that are developing academic programs now, but we've got some other things that our professional associations need to look at, not just continuing education. And that way we can build out this field as a more real profession, because we are treated, dismissed far too often as if fundraising and even the nonprofit sector are just not real, not sufficiently, I don't know, competent. So the bad news, why do you think there's a donkey here also called an ass? Because we're making too many mistakes, because we are gambling too much, if you will, because we have built too many fundraising technicians and even nonprofit technicians in general who don't know enough about all kinds of other things to build strong organizations. There are so many nonprofits that limp along or go out of business. And society deserves better. So don't be an ass. Okay. My last whatever. There is such opportunity. You know, government is pulling out of more and more things. And then they reimburse organizations, nonprofits that are fulfilling those missions, and they don't reimburse them at the full cost. The one thing that keeps growing is philanthropy. And we could grow it more if we do the right stuff, if we read the right authors, if we follow the right blogs, if we know how to develop as a profession and as professionals so that we stop the insidious bad stuff and the absurdity of board members and other powerful people who keep telling us that there's a different and better way to do things. So your master's degree, there's now even an undergraduate degree in fundraising. And we are now seeing an entire generation of fundraisers whose parents were fundraisers. In the olden days, I'm one of those people who didn't get an academic degree in fundraising. Yeah, I did an enormous amount of continuing education, and I did the International Advanced Diploma, which was really something, and academic. But we're now looking at next generations, and you will have your master's. Whether you choose to be a fundraiser, whether you choose to be an exec who needs to know enough about fundraisers so you're not that person who said, I won't sign the letter. We need to be able to work with our board members so that they understand these things just enough that they don't stop us from doing the right stuff. And we can raise more charitable contributions and build stronger organizations. We can get credentials and we can get academic degrees. So in my little fantasy world, okay, I think I would do ongoing self-study, of course, continuing education always. I would get my CFRE if I were going to be a fundraiser. I would get a master's degree in something that is not just narrowly fundraising, or because I have seen academic programs, master's degrees, that are only fundraising techniques. That's not good enough. We need organizational development, culture. We need strategic planning. You want to be a good fundraiser? You have to know about boards. So, as I say, if I were starting out right now, I'd go for ongoing continuing education. I'd get my CFRE. I'd get a master's degree. I'd probably do the International Advanced Diploma in Fundraising, which I've already done. And then maybe if I was really ambitious, I'd get a doctorate. And I would study at the Hartzick Center for Sustainable Philanthropy and do something probably on, I don't know, psychology or something. Anyway, there you have it. Those are my thoughts. Anybody have any questions, comments about anything?
I had a quick question. Why do you think it is that the UK leads research in this field?
Well, it's interesting, Greg. It's actually not the UK. It's Adrian. And Adrian just happens to live in the UK. So what happened was, boy, I don't even remember how many years ago, probably 20. The Center for Philanthropy at IUPUI, so in Indiana, was given a named chair in fundraising. So it was the first named chair in fundraising. Bob Hartsook from the Hartsook Companies gave them, you know, established a chair, and they hired Adrian Sargent. So he moved from the UK over. He had already started doing research, but he was a marketing professor who got interested in fundraising, and then he started doing academic research around fundraising. So he moved to the US and was here, wow, about a decade at least, at the Center on Philanthropy, then decided he wanted to start his own sort of different kind of a fundraising center, if you will. And also, I think, probably just wanted to move back to the UK for a while. So he moved back to the UK and he started the Hartsook Center because it was, again, it's a named center by the same, some of the same donors, and started the Center for Sustainable Philanthropy. And I'm telling you, the research on fundraising, when you then partner it with like philanthropic research, like the Lilly Family School and other centers do, it's a whole new world. It's fantastic. So it's Adrian who is the leader, and Jen, it's not the fact that they are, you know, happen to be in the UK. They're outliers in the UK. They're outliers in, outliers as in leaders in this work all over the world.
Do you also think that possibly the lack of expertise and the initiative for that is kind of dependent on the lower salaries involved in the nonprofit sector, whereas in for-profit, the more you learn, obviously, there is that financial incentive to become an expert?
You know, I don't know that there is research that's done on compensation, and frequently the level of compensation is not the determinant for wanting to stay or keeping a particular job. It's what the work environment is like, apparently, the organizational culture, the quote mission unquote, which could be, you know, a for-profit mission. So I think one of my theories, and not researched, should be researched maybe, but one of my theories is, first of all, we do know from research that any profession that is dominated by women is diminished. And more women, there are more women in fundraising, for example, than men. And the men get paid more than the women for the same work. But I think part of this is the whole relationship to the nonprofit sector that certainly the U.S. society has, which is for-profit business corporations are the dominant power structure in this country. And so if you're not, so nonprofits and the whole nonprofit sector, I think, is in some ways socially kind of, you know, demeaned. So then do you have the energy to be able to go to school on top of the job, et cetera, et cetera? So, I mean, I think your question, Greg, is really worth talking about and exploring.
We do have another question. What do you say to a board member who does not want to financially contribute because they already feel like they contribute more than enough through volunteering their time.
So the immediate response to that is any number of people volunteer their time, and volunteer time doesn't pay for certain for bills. But the most important step is that there had to be a conversation prior to the moment that this came up. And this is where boards sometimes don't do it. So the board has to have a conversation about performance expectations of all board members and adopt a policy. And then people are interviewed and screened. And they're told, you have to attend meetings, you've got to give a gift to the best of personal ability, and you explain why. And it's not negotiable. It's interesting. Why do we recruit board members without giving them a job description and performance expectations? Because they're volunteers, so we don't dare. That's crazy. It's just crazy. So if they're not motivated by the, how could we ask anybody else to give money? People, everybody in the world, lots of people volunteer. So you're asking me for a financial contribution, but you won't give because you're volunteering, but I'm volunteering a bunch of other places. So, yeah. I mean, you can, my book, Firing Lousy Board Members, talks a lot about that. There's materials in my download library. And one of the things you can do is you can say, we can't apply for grants because we don't have 100% giving by our board members. And people won't give us gifts because our board members don't give.
We have another question come in. What are the most important aspects of the relationship between fundraisers and those who set the budget?
Oh, nice question. So I have, I think, a couple blogs in my blog, you can search it, around how you set a charitable contributions goal. So one of the ways we do this is that the finance office, you know, gathers together all of the comments from everybody about this is how much money we need. So here it is. This is how much money we need. And then the finance office runs over to the development office and says, here, raise it. And the development office, who's also doing planning, goes, but we can't raise that. We don't have enough prospects. Our retention rates are a little bit low. We can't raise it. So when you set a budget, both the fundraising departments, functions, and everybody else have to work together. The smart budgeting process is looking very carefully at how many donors do we currently have? How many do we think might increase? How good are we at relationship building? What are our donor retention rates? There's a dozen items you have to look at to help you decide if you think you can raise more money, including going through every single donor. If you have, I mean, you could do that with 500 donors. You could do it at 1,000 and say, do we think they'll give more? So I once had a client of mine say, well, this is how much we need. And it's like, yeah, but you're not going to be able to raise it. So then you'll have to do budget cutting in the middle of the year. That's not so smart. And then somebody said, well, no, we'll just do it and, you know, God will provide. It's like, God will provide when you do crappy budgeting? I had no idea she was that, I don't know, forgiving. And another client of mine once actually said, oh, no, we budget for what we need and then someone dies.
So,
yeah, they're counting on someone dying and leaving a bequest. So, no, that's not the way you budget.
Wow. Uh-huh. We have a question. What aspects of leadership are most important for effective fundraising efforts and events?
I think when I think about leadership and fundraising, I think about being able to work with others, being able to build understanding of what has to be done, knowing the body of knowledge well enough to know that this is what it takes to make a good fundraising event, this is how much it's going to cost us to do this, how are we going to merge all of this together. I do not believe that people with money make good leaders. Just because I have money, I'm a good leader and I can run everything. And that's not true. So the leadership is about understanding the facts and pursuing facts. It's about helping others understand. It's about being able to address conflict and manage conflict resolution. Because I think this and you think this and she thinks that and he thinks this. So how are we going to manage that? It's about understanding, and I'm watching this with a client right now. They don't want to invest money in fundraising, but they want to raise money. But if they don't raise more money than what they've spent in expenses, then they're mad. It's like, what? Yes, eventually you want to raise more money than you're spending on raising the money. But when you're first starting something, it will cost more to acquire a new client or a new donor than what they give. That's just a reality of life. So the leadership to me is really demanding that we know the body of knowledge and being able to manage the many different people and enable them to make good decisions.
Perfect. We have one last question. How would you respond to constituents when fundraising goals are not met, especially when it correlates with the success of a particular project?
So when you're saying constituents, are you talking about your colleagues? So the entire institution, every program person, everybody has to understand how difficult it is to raise money. They have to understand what their role is in it. So if I, as a donor, have a bad experience every time I call you people on the telephone, that's the receptionist's problem. Or that's the program person's problem because I keep asking them questions and they're not answering me and I'm a donor. So we should know, all right, how hard it is to raise the money for a project. If we're proposing a new project, the fundraiser needs to tell us what the funders are going to look for, what the likelihood is that we'll get it. I can be the best fundraiser there is, and I am damn good. But if there's a recession, we will not raise as much money probably. If there's a newspaper article about how dumb we were, that will affect fundraising. If the quality of our programs aren't as good anymore, that will affect fundraising. If we don't do good relationship building, that will affect fundraising. It's all connected. So nobody should be making any promises that we think we can raise this, nor do you get to go into the development office and say, hi, I need $10,000. So there's a lack of understanding about how you budget, how you plan, and what it takes to get money.
So we have one last question that slipped in. Do you think general volunteers are good vectors for fundraising? If so, in what way, and are there limitations?
So I didn't catch the second word. Do I think volunteers are good candidates for fundraising?
It says vectors for fundraising.
All right. So all volunteers of time should be asked for a financial contribution. They know more about the organization because they're volunteering there. There should be a sort of a special acquisition program to them, a special letter to them that says, you know, you volunteer your time, this has been wonderful. And only people like you know that we still have to pay the telephone bill or whatever. Yeah, they should definitely be good candidates. And in fact, volunteers frequently give more relative to other donors. So one of my final comments would be, do not think you can convince everyone to give you money. People pay attention to what interests them. They don't pay attention to that which doesn't interest them. And you cannot educate me to give you money. My father died of cancer. One of my sisters had cancer. I still don't give to cancer organizations. It's just not my interest. Even though I'm sad that my dad died of cancer. So you can't educate people to care. And you can't convince them to care. And it sounds insulting and arrogant.
But it's a good point.
Simone, thank you so much. Really got a lot out of this webinar. And also, Alyssa, who had to leave earlier, just a few minutes ago, wanted me to explicitly say thank you for your time and wisdom.
Well, thank you for saying that, Greg. Again, the stuff in my download library, there's just tons of stuff and additional like podcasts and handouts from workshops. And if you ever, you know, if you all have a quick question or something, you can always email me.
You may get an email box full of questions because I know that all of our classmates really wanted to be here today. We just have our fundraising final due tomorrow.
Yes, that's so. What I heard.
Yeah.
Well, is this taped, Greg, so that it can be replayed?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay, good. Yeah. Wonderful.
Yeah, and it's funny, I'm actually presenting in our class tomorrow on your chapters 3 and 5 about the leadership and management abilities and the CDO.
Yeah. I'm fascinated by this concept of how leaders can't be good managers and good managers can't be leaders, which I just think is bullshit. It's just the dumbest thing I've ever heard. I've known leaders who are great managers and great managers who are leaders, and I've known people who are lousy at both or either. So,
Yeah.
Well, good. So, as I say, you can always email me. And if I get too many emails, I'll just email you all back and say, okay, stop it already.
All right, perfect.
Fair enough.
Ask me again someday.
Oh, definitely, definitely. And I know we actually have 2 fundraising classes taking place next semester.
Oh, so good.
Yeah, double the opportunity.
All right.
But thank you again for so much. There's a lot of perspective. And I have a feeling a lot of the students are going to be referencing the recording of this to help out with their report for tomorrow.
Good. Thank you.
Perfect. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Bye.
Have a good night.
You too.